Just a word of warning before today's episode of Turning Pages. My interview with Alexander Grigorescu that follows features some static on the line, unfortunately. This was, I guess, due to the use of a cell phone on one end. I eliminated as much of it as I can, but there is certainly still some crackle and pop on the recording. Please bear with me and enjoy this episode talking about Cauchemar.
Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
Cauchemar. It is, French for nightmare, first of all, but it is also the new book from Alexandra Grigorescu, and she's coming to Thin Air, the Winnipeg International Writers Festival, and she joins me on the phone to discuss the book. How are you doing, Alexandra?
I'm doing well, thanks, Michael. How are you?
I'm doing very well, although maybe a little unsettled after reading Cauchemar, I suppose.
I'm glad to hear it.
I wanted to ask you, in terms of, first of all, naming it in French. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's, you know, it's set in Louisiana, so there is the Acadie or the Cajun influence and French spoken there. But did you, like, worry in terms of, like, it getting across that this is about nightmares, or that, like, it's setting that tone for people who aren't necessarily French speakers?
I do believe that there was some back and forth about that. There was actually maybe some concern, especially about its pronunciation for people that weren't native French speakers or who perhaps hadn't really had very much experience with the French language. Mm-hmm. But the Cauchemar does figure quite largely in the book. Mm-hmm. So I did feel that it was pretty representative. And plus, you know, it's a nice little nudge to people once they're reading to know that it does actually mean nightmare in French, because hopefully the book creeps them out. So
right.
It's always a plus.
So in terms of, let's start at the very beginning. You start with a death.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious about, like, did you wrestle with, like, how the book would open, like, what would precipitate sort of the action that then follows? Or did you kind of have it in your mind that, like, death would factor in and it would be, like, let's face it, right from the start here?
Right. I think one of the big things for me is I tend to not really map out as I write. I sort of just write, and then I write without a GPS, basically. Whatever comes out, comes out. So I wasn't necessarily planning to open it with the death, but it did kind of feel like a very jarring beginning, which I think automatically puts you on edge. Mm-hmm. Because as anyone who has experienced death knows, it's quite unsettling and it rocks your world. So I just felt like it was a strong way to open the book.
For sure, yeah. That opening sense, I mean, usually, like, you know, they say give every book, like, a paragraph, but if you're not hooked on Hannah waited exactly 7 minutes before touching May's cold body, I suppose maybe this isn't necessarily your cup of tea as far as book go. You say you write without a GPS. I'm curious then, in terms of, like, how you do write. Like, if you don't necessarily know where the story's headed, how do you, like, do you just write a bunch of stuff and sort of sift through it? Or, like, what's your sort of working practice?
I have so much respect for writers that can create really elegant narrative outlines, because I'm not one of them. I sort of will write, and then if I'm finding that I'm having difficulty with a particular scene, I'll sort of just write something else, which eventually creates more work for me, because then in the end I do have to sort of sit down and through everything and construct the narrative out of it. But it does also kind of allow me to sit down and just write, because whatever is going to come out is going to be whatever I'm enjoying writing in the moment. So it's just a fun way to do it.
Like, some people, you know, write post-it notes and sort of keep track of either characters or, you know, episodes within a story. Then, like, how do you then sort of keep tabs on things when you're writing without this GPS or without a map? Like, what's...
I get really invested in my setting and my characters. So I think some part of my brain is kind of keeping it all stashed away, and my recall is relatively good. So, I mean, for sure, like, I'll write down little notes here and there. And then sort of in the post-draft section, then there you kind of have to sit down and look at, then you map it out, basically. But the initial part is kind of in the dark.
So that sort of first write is just kind of whatever comes out of you, and then at that point you kind of sift through it once you have like kind of a complete story.
Yeah, it's kind of like molding putty.
Right. Now you said you have, you know, sort of setting and character, and you have a good sense of both of those. Did one come first? Like, was like Hannah, you know, the creation that you wanted to kind of write about, or was it, you know, this setting or sort of the plot that came first? Like, what did you have in your idea?
So I guess the actual genesis of it was Christabel, and it wasn't Christabel fully formed. It was just this idea of this powerful woman that was really outcast by the townspeople and who had like a real darkness inside her, but also like the deeper you dug, like a real humanity as well. And then the setting just kind of came to me pretty naturally, I think. It's hard to sort of have any kind of encounter with the South and not become completely entranced by it. It's just so powerful. It hits all your senses.
So Christabel, just to, I guess maybe for listeners who haven't read the book,
obviously, oh, yeah,
is Hannah's mother. Hannah's the sort of central character, and as we said, this is set in Louisiana. She's an outcast because she's sort of practices like she's a sorceress or some, like, what would you describe her as? Like, do you have like a term for her? Because of course there's like epithets bandied about who she is.
I know, yeah. I think for me, it's just she speaks to the dead. Does that kind of encapsulate it?
Yeah, no, because that's, I mean, you know, there has to be sort of a succinct thing that she would maybe think of herself as, or you as the creator thinks of her as, versus like the characters who interact with her who have like not necessarily nice things to say about her.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Right.
I think just speaker to the dead. And actually, speaker to the dead is in some ways better than speaks to the dead, because speaker to the dead kind of almost implies that, you know, she's not always necessarily opening the conversation. It's just, and hopefully by the end of the book, there is sort of a sense that, you know, this was in some sense thrust upon her. You know, it's not something she's really voluntarily, or not at the beginning, she wasn't really voluntarily seeking out.
Right. It's interesting you make a definitive sort of difference between speaks and speaker, right? Like speaks is like a kind of like it's initiated by that person, and it's almost like autocratic, right? Like that
mm-hmm.
This is what I'm telling the dead, right? Like, you know, and people come to them on their behalf, but the communication really kind of flows in one way versus, you know, speaker to the dead suggests, you know, this different relationship with the spirit world.
Yeah. Mouthpiece to the dead, maybe.
Sure enough. Yeah. So you had her in mind first.
Yes.
So then was it like in thinking of kind of her life and her sort of trajectory that you came up with, like having a daughter and then, you know, the well, relationship with her daughter and being estranged and having someone else raise her? Like,
I think I'm a big reader. So I think for me, I mean, for anyone who really reads a lot of genre, but not even necessarily genre, there's always, you kind of bring in the reader through an introduction. It's always more interesting for the reader when they experience the world along with their character.
Mm-hmm.
So to have someone that was already sort of fully entrenched in that world didn't feel to me like it would necessarily be as interesting as someone who was sort of trying to figure out how to navigate this world where everything is suddenly threatening and there's dangers at every turn. You know, if it's old trick, if it's an old hat kind of thing for your character, it's not as interesting.
Right. Like Hannah, I mean, there's, you say, you know, sort of genre fiction, there's like that trope of like the babe in the woods, right?
And then, yeah.
Like if you follow them along, you're scared on their behalf, right? Like the,
exactly.
As they go through things kind of naively and you feel kind of the forest encroaching on them. And in this case, it's a swamp instead of a forest, but she's, mm-hmm. you know, she's the babe in the woods or the babe in the swamp in this instance, that you're kind of lulling the reader into kind of discovering things as she discovers them.
Yeah, definitely.
So then, I mean, because she lives in isolation at first, right, with with May, and then it's kind of pulled into the town and experiences kind of, or at least revisits some of her own experiences as being sort of cast out as a result of the town's relationship with her mother. And I was curious, was there any thoughts of sort of like allegorical implications of, you know, like difference and closed-mindedness? Like, were you thinking of like any particular group that's aspersions are cast onto, or that like communities look down on?
Not necessarily in a conscious sense, but I think that that was definitely kind of bubbling under the surface. It's more that, again, it's part of the side effect of not really having a GPS, right? You kind of look at it after the fact and you realize that, yeah, probably. I'm not a fan of discrimination. And there's a lot of it in the world. So for sure, like, I've said this before in other interviews, like, I think Poshmark is kind of, the difference that's there is an allegory for a difference everywhere, regardless of whether it's, you know, like a visible group or whether it's just, you know, you feel different and you're, cast out because of it. And it's about, you know, like the fear that comes with that. And certain parts in Koshmar, actually, there's almost like an internalization of having been cast out, right? Like, can't actually start to wonder if she is bad because she's been cast out. And there's almost like a sense of acceptance that comes through that. But hopefully by the end, you know, she really regains her agency and she, she understands that, you know, like she has to own, herself.
Right. Yeah. Like there's a sequence kind of, a little ways in where she's at a grocery store and tries to buy groceries. And it's like, you know, the person just kind of looks through her and essentially it's not like, we don't serve your kind here kind of circumstance.
Yeah.
And then her friend tries to stick up for her and she's like, no, it's okay. I understand. And like leaves.
Yeah.
And yeah, like you said, that internalizing and kind of like accepting it or in some way not kind of pushing back against it.
Yeah. Well, and I think, and that's also part of the Babe in the Woods trajectory of the book. She begins as a really passive character where a lot of bad things happen to her. And then she kind of starts to stick up for herself and she grows a backbone.
Yeah.
Which is nice to see.
For sure. Yeah, no, absolutely. She befriends or gets involved with this guy Callum, this part-time musician, and I'm always curious about naming in books in terms of like whether authors, you know, look up the meanings of these people's names when they choose to make these characters, right, so that they embody something. And Callum, the Scottish thing, is like calm, right? Like that that's one of the sort of central meanings of the name. And he is this sort of like relatively placid and fixed point for Hannah. Was that intentional for you that he kind of embody that?
I didn't know about the meaning when I was writing the book. Again, GPS.
Yeah.
But no, for sure. Like he's meant to be a signpost for her. He's meant to be a lighthouse, right? He's meant to be something to guide her through this incredibly, incredibly difficult time in her life. And I think part of the stakes of the book are that her own, if you want to call them dark powers, eventually begin to threaten him, which is made all the more devastating because he has been this really grounding force in her life.
Right. One of the first sort of jarring sequences that I can think of is a nightmare that Hannah has that she ends up in the hospital. And I don't want to like give away too much in terms of plot for folks who haven't read it, but you know, at first when you're reading it, you are not sure if she's, you know, like experiencing the she ends up bleeding, let's say, and it's like, oh, is this still in her dream or her nightmare? Has she woken up? And there's like this sort of blurring of the line of like what's happening in her dream and what's actually happening to her in real life. And that's kind of like the schism point where things change for Hannah. And I was curious about sort of that, the construction of that scene, but also kind of like shifting the reader or maybe pushing them towards this change in things. And like, this is a cauchemar. This is one of the true nightmares within the context of the book.
I think that's part of what I was trying to do throughout the book, just this 100% blurring of the lines, where you're never really quite sure what's real, what's not, what's dangerous, what's not. And that scene, I think, for me was, it sort of begins as a part of the nightmare, but then actually kind of becomes really stark and becomes really real. And it's definitely a turning point in the book, but it's not a nightmarish turning in the book for me, I don't think. It's very stark because it's really puts her at risk. I'm also trying not to give too much away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I'm always a little wary. Yeah.
It's the point at which she becomes completely vulnerable, in some ways even more than she was at the beginning of the book. I'm really choosing my words.
Yeah. So when you've written a book like this, where there are some turns and some reveals that I think are rewarded within the context of reading the book, like how do you go about kind of like talking about this book or like pitching this book to readers without like giving things away, right? Like does that present a problem to you as an author to kind of talk about your work without kind of giving too much?
I have in the past had a bad habit of just kind of saying, oh, and then this happened. And watching the person I was speaking to, their face just kind of be like, oh my God. I had no idea that was going to happen based on the book jacket. So I've since learned to pull back and to be really mysterious and to just kind of stick to the Southern Gothic. And there's a very vulnerable 20-year-old girl in it and supernatural forces around her. So I think definitely my sort of elevator pitch has changed somewhat. Through lessons learned.
For sure. So in terms of setting, like, did you do any sort of research on Louisiana or like visit or like read up on sort of the setting so that you could kind of get the ambience right? Or was this entirely sort of like, you know, authorial creation?
It's a mix of both. I did actually visit and I fell in love with it even more than my research would have suggested, which was very nice. But there is definitely a heavy veneer of my imagination over it. You know, it's sort of Louisiana with a twist. And it's sort of harkening back to a lot of genre fiction that's set in that area. Like, there's always kind of everything is amped up. Everything is really vivid. But yeah, I definitely researched it quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But also put my own twist on it.
So were you a fan of like sort of Southern Gothic genre fiction before this? Like, is this something that you read fairly regularly and wanted to kind of tap into, or was this kind of sort of more of a like creative experiment for you? Like, what led you to a story like this or this kind of style?
I have been a huge fan of the horror genre for most of my life in film and literature, so that definitely helped. But Southern Gothic's not necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I love a good horror yarn.
Is it like the catharsis of the experience? Like, I know a lot of people who like it just kind of to be scared to kind of like release tension or something. But some people really like the horror genre for kind of working through present day circumstances or sort of larger issues within it, within a genre piece that, you know, can, it's like the spoonful of sugar making the medicine go down, only kind of like a warped version of that.
I definitely agree with the idea of it representing a lot of issues that we're facing now and have always faced. I've always really insisted that the horror genre should be taken much more seriously than it is, because it is. It's just a twist on what we see around us all the time. And in some ways, it's really heightened, all the sensations are heightened, but if you kind of dig below the surface, it's 100% familiar. It's completely relatable. So for me, I think horror just is a way to kind of look at things that we aren't always comfortable addressing in plain language.
Mm-hmm. So now that you've kind of delved into the horror genre, like, do you have an like eagerness to do any other genre work, or like, is there like, is this kind of like your lane and you kind of like to stay in this, or is there another genre that you're a fan of that you'd want to kind of explore or take a stab at writing?
I actually read a lot more. Not that I think there should necessarily be a distinction between these, but a lot of literary fiction. That's kind of the bulk of my reading. But sci-fi, I actually love science fiction. I always have horror, in film and literature as well.
Right.
So I would actually love to branch out into that, but we'll see, one thing at a time.
Yeah, and I mean, sci-fi, the thing in terms of, like, you know, when we talk about horror kind of working through present-day circumstances, sci-fi kind of imagining solutions or, like, future, like, that future casting portion, yeah, of sci-fi to kind of, like, address, like, oh, here's a roadmap or here's a possibility for the future. Is that kind of the same, like, sort of shared interest with horror that, like, it does kind of tackle today in some way?
It tackles today in some way. Sometimes it's a roadmap to a solution, but sometimes it's actually just showing us where it will go if we keep going wrong.
The more dystopic kind of...
exactly, yeah. Which is, I don't know, you know, it's that idea of the villain is always more interesting than the hero, right? And there's something really interesting about seeing a dystopian future. And there's always the relief of knowing that we're not in it, which I think is, again, kind of playing back to the idea of catharsis.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that you try to resist giving too much away now with sort, mm-hmm, of selling the book. So when you come to do a reading, like at the Writers, mm-hmm, Festival, what portion of the book do you choose to kind of do that without giving too much away? Like how do you
yeah,
give us a slice of the book when you're doing a reading without, you know, cheating yourself out of the reader's surprise down the line?
Well, when I've done previous readings, my practice has kind of been to choose to pluck out a scene that's sort of slightly out of context, give kind of a vague idea of where we're located within the narrative. And I always choose a scene that's really quite frightening, because I think that kind of almost plays into the idea of the book, right? It's displacement, it's, you know, you're not really quite sure where you are, you're not 100% sure what's going on. And the key is to kind of leave them with a little bit of a gasp. So that's the idea.
Sure enough. The the cover art kind of suggests that, like, that sort of hazy, don't know where you are kind of thing. Did you have a hand in terms of, like, working with CCW, the publisher, as to kind of what the book would look like? Like, was that something that was important to you, was, you know, getting a say in kind of how it was presented visually?
ECW is an incredible, incredible publisher. I have had the most wonderful experience with them, and the cover art is actually part of that. I'm so incredibly pleased with the cover. It's beautiful. You know, they definitely asked me my opinion, and obviously I was very enthused by the finished product. It's pretty gorgeous, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and it's absolutely in fitting with the book that's inside it.
Yeah.
Sometimes cover art can be very misleading. It's meant to, I guess, grab your attention, but doesn't necessarily hew to what's inside it. So,
yeah, it's a quiet cover. It's a quiet cover that the more you look at it, the more uncomfortable it becomes.
Yeah, for sure. Well, the book is Koshmar, Alexander Grigorescu. Alexander, thanks very much for taking some time to talk about it, and looking forward to seeing you here at the Writers' Festival.
Thank you so much, Michael.